Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. As New Hampshire prepares to enter a midterm election year, in just a few short weeks, political cross-currents are at play which will keep political observers on the edge of their seats for most of the next 12 months. While our popular Republican governor navigates the uncertain terrain around our Republican president, an all-Democratic congressional delegation hopes to hold on to both seats in the U.S. House of Representatives in what will likely be a pair of hotly contested midterm races. All of this political action is taking place in a highly polarized partisan environment in which New Hampshire residents are still expressing optimism about the future of the Granite State, but deep concerns about the future of our national political institutions. Today on The Exchange, we're taking the political temperature of New Hampshire, and we'd like to hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have three guests joining me in studio for the show this morning. Chris Galdieri, he's Associate Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. And Chris, it's good to see you.
Glad to be back, Dean. Thanks.
Kevin Landrigan, he's Senior Reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, where he writes the paper's Granite Status column. And Kevin, thanks for coming in this morning.
Great to be back, Dean.
And Paul Steinhauser, he's a New Hampshire political reporter and former CNN political editor. And Paul, it's good to see you too.
Great to be here. Thanks.
We're going to talk about the current political mood in New Hampshire in a moment, but let's first talk on New Hampshire's longer-term political identity. And Kevin, sure. You've been covering politics in the state for several decades. How would you describe the state's evolving political identity?
Yeah, well, Dean, thanks. Good morning. It's the identity's really totally changed. I can remember when I was one of my first political memories around. It was around 1983 in New Hampshire. Ronald Reagan came here, spoke in front of the State House before 25,000 people, and declared New Hampshire to be the most Republican state in the country. And at that time, he was right. The legislature was 2.5-1 Republican. There had never been a Speaker of the House or a Senate President or a majority. Democratic electorate since the Civil War in New Hampshire, but so much has changed over these last 25 years. In 2006, Democrats make historic gains here in New Hampshire, basically take over all the levers of power, and now we are where we've been for a number of cycles, which is we're so much of a swing state, and your opener really captures that. I mean, when you have everyone in control of any power in Concord, Republican, and anyone in control of any power in Washington, Democratic, in New Hampshire, that sort of tells you the dichotomy we have here. And we're in every swing election and every midterm election, the party out of power has all the momentum. And that's what we're seeing, and I think this polling will show that, is in 2010, in the Obama midterm, conservative Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans, had all the momentum. Now we're seeing the reverse is true. As we approach the midterm of Donald Trump, his first midterm, all the momentum, all the enthusiasm is on the Liberal Democratic side.
Yeah, Paul?
You know, Kevin brings a great perspective from New Hampshire. I was with the national media for years until I came up here 3 years ago, and I'm great to be here. For the national media, we always looked at New Hampshire for decades because it was the first in the nation primary state. But the last two decades, national media gives a lot of attention to this state. Why? Because it's really become one of the best swing states in the country when it comes to races for Congress, when it comes to race for the White House, the general election, and when it comes to the state level, state house races. This is truly one of the quintessential swing states, and it's easy to get to from Washington. That's why this state is getting so much attention.
And Chris, you and I study the presidency, and it is true that when we talk about the Electoral College and about presidential elections in particular, we're always one of 8 or 10 states that are in the mix.
That's right. New Hampshire has evolved into a genuinely swing state. It's always hotly contested. If Al Gore had carried New Hampshire in 2000, Florida would have been an afterthought. And so we see every 4 years, New Hampshire gets lots and lots of attention, even after the primary, because these four votes are in play, because it's such a state with such a swing from Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, and even you mentioned Florida 2000. There are a lot of Democrats who are still unhappy with Ralph Nader for running because they think could have won New Hampshire, and then mm-hmm. that would have made Florida irrelevant. Let's talk a little bit about the current political temperature. We've discussed New Hampshire clearly is a swing state. The last presidential election was very closely contested, a couple thousand votes in favor of Hillary Clinton, and even President Trump is contesting that. Paul, let me turn to you first. What would you say the temperature of the state is right now? I jotted down a couple of different descriptions before the show. Is it agitated, fatigued, ambivalent, hot, cold? What do you think? How does it feel to you? You're out there every day covering political stories.
Agitated is a good word. Fatigue, no, I don't think there's ever any fatigue here in this state when it comes to politics. It's the state sport, campaign politics. That's why we're talking about it for the hour. There's a lot of agitation right now in the state, and you're seeing these battles play out on a daily basis, be it raising the tolls or Medicaid expansion. There is a lot of political energy in the state right now by Democrats. They're energized. They had some big wins this year. But Republicans are not deaf. No way are they rolling over and playing dead at all. There's going to be a serious fight in 2018, not only at the ballot box, but at some major, major issues that will be fought over in the state house.
We're talking about the political temperature in New Hampshire today. We're just about to head into a midterm election year. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm in studio with Chris Galdieri from St. Anselm, Kevin Landrigan from the Union Leader, and Paul Steinhauser, a veteran New Hampshire political reporter as well. Kevin, your sense of the temperature right now. So New Hampshireites haven't had enough?
No, not at all. And I think back to Paul's point, I do think people are worked up, and I think they're worked up on both sides. A lot is talked about, and rightfully so, at the impeach Trump movement and on the left, this aggressive attempt to delegitimize this president. But not a lot is talked about how strong and how passionate and how committed Trump supporters have remained. And that is true here in New Hampshire. And you can certainly argue that core group is probably a little smaller than it was in November. But there was a great anecdote this week nationally from someone who is familiar to New Hampshire, John McCain, 2-time New Hampshire presidential primary winner. His supporters, this gives you just a glimpse into how committed Trump's followers are. The person who runs McCain's Twitter account said, hey, we're only 170 followers away from 3 million. And he goes on Twitter and says, can you help us out? Put us over the top. He lost 20,000 Twitter followers that day within an hour and a half of his campaign, his folks making that plea. It was all Trump's people saying, Trump, fake news. He's a faux Republican. He wasn't with us on health care. He denigrates the president's foreign policy. It's just an indication of to what Paul was saying, people on the Republican side, and particularly the Trump followers, they aren't laying down. They're very passionate, and they're committed, and they're looking forward to this midterm.
Chris, I'm interested in your initial thoughts as well.
Yeah, I think it's true that Trump supporters are very, very committed to Trump. But I think one of the things that's going to make 2018 complicated for Republicans is, can people who are running for the Republican nominations for the congressional seats or in other state elections, how can you retain Trump supporters and the sort of old line Yankee Republicans, people who have been very critical of Trump during the primary since then, some of whom, like Gordon Humphrey, went as far as to, endorse Clinton, and he's said it's time to use the 25th Amendment and everything. And I think it's going to be really difficult for Republicans to, bring those two wings of the party together.
Paul, you want to jump in?
Yeah, Trump is, as we head into the 2018 midterm season, Trump is going to be an issue for Republicans just as he was in 2016, but it's so much more compounded now because he's the president. Governor Sununu is doing great. He's got a 60% approval rating. Man, I mean, you'd think he's got this reelection sewn up. He's going to have to answer questions at every case about Donald Trump. I mean, today at the Executive Council meeting, when he talks to reporters afterward, we may ask him about Trump's support and the RNC support now for Roy Moore in Alabama. So these kind of questions Republican politicians will not be able to avoid.
Let's break it down a little bit in terms of parties and political institutions. And let's start with polarization between the parties. It sure feels like polarization in the state is at an all-time high. And Kevin, I'm interested in your take on kind of the relative strength of the two major parties in the state. If you follow them on social media, they seem to fight each other tooth and nail over even the most mundane political items. Nothing goes unresponded to. What's your sense of kind of where the two parties are in terms of relative strength going into the midterm?
Yeah, I think both parties, to your point, Dean, and it's true, I think both parties are fighting not for legitimacy, but for supremacy. Both insist they're the party in power. The Republicans, to Paul's point, we've got the governor, we've got the legislature, we've got the executive council, we're the party in power. The Democrats insist we got the first all-Democratic, all-female delegation in American history. We're the party in power. We're the ones who are standing at the transom keeping Trump from adopting policies that we don't want. So that's why we're seeing even more polarization between the parties than we saw during the 2016 election. It's hard to believe, but it's true. As we'll go through the data here on issue after issue after issue, the Democrats, by a lopsided view, feel this way, whether it's the role of business or government regulation of Wall Street, whether the economic system is fair to the average middle-class person. Democrats feel one way on this polar opposite, and Republicans feel predominantly the other way on the opposite.
Yeah, it's interesting. The UNH Survey Center has done some research on this and released some results in the past month. And just to put some numbers to the kind of polarization you're suggesting, they found that 87% of Democrats, but only 33% of Republicans, agree that good diplomacy is best for peace. And also 62% of Republicans, but only 35% of Democrats agree that government is almost always wasteful. So two sort of very bold examples of polarization between the parties. Chris, let me turn to you. There has been a lot of discussion among political scientists and others about divisions within the two parties. And so, again, I'm looking at more UNH data. Republicans talking about their own party. 79% of Republicans say the GOP is divided. Yet 87% say the party represents their values very or somewhat well. Democrats, 56% say their own party is divided, but 91% say the party represents their values somewhat or very well. So talk a little bit about the internal divisions, mm-hmm. even though kind of ideologically there seems to be sort of a fair degree of happiness with sort of where the parties are ideologically.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at the Republican side, what you continue to see is this split between Trump and more traditional conservatives. And if you are a Republican, you look at things like Bob Corker's lack of support for Trump, or Jeff Flake's book, or John McCain's dramatic votes this summer on healthcare. So you look at those and you see a Republican Party, and you feel like it's not standing up for and it's not supporting Donald Trump, and you see that division, and so it matters to you. I think Democrats, there are divisions between sort of, what we could call the Clinton camp and the Sanders camp, but Democrats have the advantage of being the party out of power. They don't have to advance an agenda. They don't have to come to an agreement or make compromises to get something done. So they have the advantage of just sitting back and criticizing. And when you're doing that, you know, those divisions are kind of easy to paper over.
So, Paul, I'm interested in your thoughts, kind of internal divisions with the party. Is it really going to really have any sort of impact on what happens in the midterm?
Yeah, it will. And you know, Chris was just concentrating on the Republicans. Let me just talk about the Democrats. And yesterday we had a perfect example of those divisions of the Democratic Party here in New Hampshire. Hillary Clinton was in town to sign books at Gibson's. Well, besides Vermin Supreme, who was protesting outside, the perennial presidential candidate, so were some Bernie Sanders supporters. They were out there with their signs. And I thought it was interesting. A year later, these divisions between the Bernie Sanders supporters here in the state, and they did very well and were very impressive in the primary, and the Hillary Clinton camp still exist. This establishment versus progressive split, we're seeing it play out at the Democratic National Committee, and we'll probably see it play out in some of the primaries here. We've got to have a great Democratic primary in the first congressional district, and we're going to see these divisions play out. Are they bad or good for the party? I think sometimes contested primaries and divisions like this make a party stronger.
We're talking about New Hampshire's political temperature today. You can join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, and I'll get that right here in the studio. Kevin, so, you know, we putting the divisions within the parties aside, the sort of the bigger point of ideology, you know, Democrats favor diplomacy, Republicans favor military strength, Democrats favor government programs, Republicans are very distrustful. Is there anything here that kind of feels new or different to you than in the past? Because some might say, well, you know, these are just sort of long-standing, persistent differences between the party. But does anything feel a little bit different now?
Yeah, one thing that feels a little different is the question in the survey that talked about to both parties, how do you want your future leaders to be? In other words, how do you want your future Republican leaders to be? And what's different here is Republicans seem very conflicted about that question. And I think that speaks to Trump and the dilemma for establishment Republicans that Chris was talking about to Trump. 37% say they want their future Republicans to be more conservative than leaders right now. But 34% of Republicans say they want their leaders to be more moderate than their leaders are right now. There isn't the same kind of dichotomy among Democrats. There, to Paul's point, more Democrats and the activist Democrats want their future leaders to be more liberal, more progressive than they are right now, and not more moderate. So that's what's different, I think, and that's the dilemma and the quandary facing Republicans entering into this midterm. Their party seems very divided unto itself in terms of which direction they want to go in 2018 and going forward.
Yeah, and we're certainly seeing that play out at the national level as well, as though there is, you know, some criticism that they're willing to put aside some of those differences for the sake of a particular policy, in this case, the tax cuts. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Chris, let me turn to you and talk a little bit about political institutions. We've talked about parties. The other big thing political scientists like to talk about are political institutions. Pretty low, I'm looking at the UNH survey data, pretty low confidence in our political institutions. Overall, the presidency, about 30% confidence, although Republicans are up at 58%, which arguably the Republican president strikes me as a little bit low. Congress is always low, 14%, 17% among Republicans. Say a little bit about what you think is going on nationally. And what do you think is causing that?
Well, I mean, in the very long term, you can see a decline in trust in institutions that goes all the way back to the 1960s and 70s with Vietnam and Watergate and subsequent scandals. What I think we're seeing now is that you don't even have partisan boosting those approval ratings. If you're a Republican, you look at Congress and you're incredibly frustrated. You don't see a Congress that has moved forward on many of the things that Trump campaigned on. You've seen, one failed health care repeal attempt after another. This tax bill did pass the Senate, but there's, anything could still happen in the conference committee and what, depending on what happens in Alabama and so on. So I think you don't have a whole lot to show for it. And I think the low trust among Republicans in the presidency, which you'd expect to be pretty high when you have a Republican in the White House, again, reflects that I think there's a fair amount of ambivalence among a lot of Republicans about Donald Trump and what he has been able to do in office and what he hasn't.
And Paul, there's an interesting tidbit in the UNH survey data. They note that in October of 2011, the most important problem facing the nation, and we're not talking just about the state, but facing the nation, according to New Hampshire respondents, 65% said jobs and the economy. November 2017, so last month, the most important problem facing the nation, the highest, is the presidency at 17%, jobs at 9%. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, well, we've come a long way with this economic recovery. It's been slow. It's been painful. But we're definitely not in the place we were back in 2008, 9, and 10 when the economy was the serious thing that almost brought this country down. The presidency, not a surprise. I mean, we have the most divisive president we've ever experienced in our life. In this country's history, arguably, somebody who Democrats say is a divider, not a uniter, who plays off divisions. And I think those poll numbers, I think they tell the story of how Americans right now are not only troubled with the institutions themselves, but with the person in the White House.
Kevin,
yes.
Let's talk specifically about President Trump's relationship with New Hampshire. You know, we have sort of the more general concerns with confidence in our institutions. You know, some of that has been around for a while. I don't think it's just Trump. But I am interested in talking about his relationship. How would you characterize his current relationship? We know that he did quite well here in the New Hampshire primary, won, I think, about 35 or 37% of the vote, something like that, narrowly lost the state to Hillary Clinton, the general, but he seemed reasonably popular. How is he doing now here? I think his overall approval in the state I have is about 33%, but he's at 74% among Republicans. So what do you make of it?
He is, and I think that's sort of what we've expected with him and hasn't changed dramatically, which is that his overall approval rating has been sliding downward. It's true. But his support among Republicans has held firm. There was some dip, but it has held firm. I know this president personally feels very passionate about New Hampshire. He wanted New Hampshire in a bad way and still You've seen the comments about voter fraud. He still feels he earned New Hampshire, and he's determined in 2020, if he runs again, and I expect he will, he's determined to win New Hampshire. Because he feels some debt to New Hampshire as well, that his overwhelming victory in the presidential primary catapulted him there. But in terms of approval and disapproval, the it is important that these just over half, 51%, strongly disapprove of this president in New Hampshire. Now, that's the greatest majority since September 2008.
Since Bush.
At the nadir of George W. Bush's presidency and before we historically elected Barack Obama to replace him.
Chris?
Yeah, and just to follow up on the Bush comparison, I mean, to get to that number, George W. Bush had a very long war in Iraq that became very unpopular. He had an economic crisis. And Donald Trump is at the same place. And the economy is we have a solid, strong economy. Unemployment is low. Gas prices are low. We haven't had a major international crisis. You know, I look at that number and I wonder, well, what happens if something, you know, if there is one, you know, what if the economy takes a downturn? What if something happens in North Korea or something like that?
We do have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll keep talking about politics in New Hampshire. We're going to start talking about some of the important congressional races for next year. And we'll also hear from Paul Steinhauser about this issue of President Trump. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
We are asking Leadership Circle to play a very important role in expanding the capacity of NHPR.
Marshall Rowe is chair of NHPR's Board of Trustees.
We play a leading role in communicating what's happening in New Hampshire and how it's affecting all of us.
And NHPR's Leadership Circle helps to make that happen.
Join the circle with your tax-deductible year-end gift at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, in for Laura Kanoi. Today on The Exchange, we're diving into the divisive politics of New Hampshire. So let's hear from you. You can call into the show at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have three guests in studio with me today. Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire political reporter and former CNN political editor. Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, where he writes the paper's Granite Status column. And Chris Galdieri, associate professor of politics at St. Anselm College. And before the break, we were talking about President Trump's relationship with New Hampshire. We noted that his overall approval in the state is at 33%, although he's at 74% among Republicans, only 5%, not surprisingly, among Democrats. Same kind of polarization that we've discussed on the economy. 85% of Republicans approve of his handling of the economy, while only 10% of Democrats. Foreign policy, 77% of Republicans, 5% of Democrats. Right track, wrong track, 64% yes Republicans, only 11% Democrats. This is the UNH survey data from, I believe, October of this year. So, Paul, I want to get your thoughts in a moment, but I wanted to mention it was quite remarkable. One more sign of the polarization around President Trump. The UNH Survey Center did a word cloud in which you ask respondents for what one word best describes the individual, in this case, best describes President Trump. And the more frequency of use of the word, the bigger the word is in the print. People have probably seen these word clouds where some words are really large and some words are really small. So just to give you an example of this extreme polarization, Republicans who were asked about what one word best describes President Trump, the top four answers were strong, leader, businessman, patriot. When Democrats were asked the same question, what one word best describes President Trump, the top four answers were incompetent, idiot, moron, and I can't say the fourth word on the radio. So just remarkable polarization like I probably have never seen before. For as much as George W. Bush was controversial with Democrats, and Obama was with Republicans, this is pretty remarkable. So your thoughts on Trump and New Hampshire?
Yeah, three quick points. First of all, he was up here more than two dozen times in the primaries and during the general election. He has not been in New Hampshire since the eve of the election. He had a humongous rally at the arena in downtown Manchester, has not been back since. He's visited almost 30 states since he's been in the White House. Hasn't been here yet. Now, granted, most of those states are states he won. He didn't win here, obviously, though he says voter, you know, that's another issue. I've talked to the White House and they said nothing imminent. Is it upsetting his supporters? No. They say that he'll be here when it matters in 2018 or 2019 as he, you know, for the midterms or when he gears up for re-election. Second point is, well, he called it a drug-infested den, right? He expressed his love and professed his love for our state so many times. And we all remember the big story over the summer that in a conversation with the Mexican president earlier this year, he called New Hampshire a drug-infested den. Third point is this, and this is a good one for New Hampshire. I think it's safe to say on the Republican side, our primary will stay first in the nation in the Republican calendar because Donald Trump does love New Hampshire and does love the primary. It gave him his first win. So I don't think we have any concerns about that.
And I want to mention just once again that all of the survey data that we've discussed thus far in the show is from the UNH Survey Center, surveys that they put out in October and November of this year. You can find it online. I encourage you to check it out. It's really interesting stuff. Let's turn our attention now to the actual 2018 midterm elections. They're just around the corner. A couple of sort of New Year's for political scientists here in New Hampshire will be all right. We're in a midterm election year, that is going to have a big impact on whether the temperature in New Hampshire heats up or cools down. Let's start with we don't have any U.S. Senate races, so we have the two House races, Congressional District 1 and CD 2. Let's start with CD 1 and. Kevin, let me turn to you first. Say a little bit about the geography of CD1 and the political complexion of CD1.
Sure. As we talked about with regard to the political identity opening of the show, I think the first congressional district kind of embodies that, right? I mean, after all, this is a seat in which the Democrat and Republican present and former congressmen swapped victories four times, right? Carol Shea Porter winning twice, the Democrat in the office, Frank Ginter, the Republican out of office, booted last November, having won twice as well. This is the eastern half of the state. It is actually, by party registration, a slightly Republican-leaning state. I think it's R plus 2 or R plus 3, depending on which voter registration you use. Manchester is certainly the central focus, but you also have major cities on the seacoast: Dover, Rochester, Somersworth, Portsmouth, all together actually make up a greater emphasis. So a candidate who can do well in Manchester but clean up on the seacoast is generally the congressman or woman.
This is hands down, maybe I'm a little biased because I live here, this is probably the best, most expensive, most fought over swing congressional district in the country. As Kevin said, it's ping pong back and forth the last four elections. The same two candidates. Well, we don't have either of them this time. Carol Shea Porter's not running for re-election, and we don't think Frank Ginter is good, but he hasn't ruled it out 100%. I covered the Democratic Forum. This was the first time that there's six Democrats running already, and we may get one or two more. They had a forum this past weekend. The Democratic Party here held it, and it was fascinating. And you know what was the most interesting thing for me? The most energetic speeches came from the two oldest candidates in the race, Lincoln Soldati, the former Stafford County attorney, and from Mark McKenzie, who was the head of the AFL-CIO here for 25 years. Chris Pappas, the executive counselor, yeah, he's probably the best-known candidate. He'll probably raise the most money. I guess you could say he's the early favorite, but obviously his jumping into the race has not, you know, kept anybody else out. We have six Democrats in this race. We've only got two Republicans so far, State Senator Andy Sanborn of Bedford, the conservative, and Eddie Edwards over there in the Seacoast as well. Matt Mayberry, the former New Hampshire vice chair of the state party, may jump in. Why all this excitement? Because the seat is open for the first time since 2002. It's been a long time.
And we should mention there are two candidates on the Republican side, Andy Sanborn,
right.
Eddie Edwards.
Right.
Chris, interested in your thoughts as a political scientist about how this particular House election in the district will play out. You know, sometimes we talk about parties trying to make all politics local. Other times we say these House seats in particular just kind of go with the kind of national trend.
Yeah, I think it's a little of both. I think if you want proof that Democrats think that 2018 is going to be a good year for them, and you look at the size of that Democratic field, these are candidates who think that if they can get the nomination, they have a very good shot of representing that district. They're also worried, I think, that if they don't run this year, they might not get the chance for two or four or six or eight or however many years again. I think in terms of national trends, if 2018 does turn out to be a wave year, what you see a lot of times when you have a big wave is that sometimes people get swept into office who might not otherwise have. And then the challenge for them is, can you find a way to hold on when that wave goes out in two or four years?
Yeah, you think about Carol Shea Porter in 2006. Mm-hmm. That was a Democratic tsunami. Frank Ginter, 2010, that was the Tea Party. So they really kind of went with the flow there. And Kevin, let me hear from you. I had a very good email from Aubrey in Portsmouth who raised a good point. We're talking a lot about the polarization between Democrats and Republicans, the polling results, which I should mention, NHPR will link to on the webpage, so you can find the link there as well. Aubrey wants to know, okay, so the Republican and Democratic stuff is predictable.
Is.
What about the role of independents? How are independents skewing in the state?
Yeah, and that's the problem for folks like Andy Sanborn and Eddie Edwards, because for issue after issue after issue, independents are trending, cresting more with Democratic points of view than with Republican points of view, whether it's the economic system being unfairly favoring the powerful, 89% of Democrats, 72% of independents. Is there too little regulation of Wall Street? 58% of Democrats say yes, 40% of independents say yes. Is government always inefficient? 62% of Republicans say government is always inefficient, but only 46% of independents do. So, as I say, from issue after issue, the concern, and Paul referenced this as well, in the midterm election, The challenge for folks like Andy Sanborn and Eddie Edwards is going to be is how do you keep the Trump supporters on board while at the same time appealing to independents, many of whom who are repulsed by Trump?
Paul, let me hear your thoughts on independence, but also a question that I had as well, but Logan has emailed us and asked the same question. In that first CD race on the Democratic side, is there any kind of Bernie-Hillary thing sort of playing out there? Some people have suggested, you know, McKenzie is kind of a Bernie guy and Pappas is kind of a Hillary guy. And I'm just interested to hear your thoughts. Independence, but then also the sort of presidential overlay from the 2016 Democratic primary.
Yeah, independents or undeclared voters are such a crucial part of our state. We all know that. And they could vote in either primary. So it'll be interesting to see in the first CD where they go. Right now, all the action really seems, the most exciting action seems to be on the Democratic side. That could change. I mean,
do you think more Republicans will get in on the other side? Or
yeah, I think Mayberry may jump in. That'll make it three. And who knows with Ginta? I doubt it. But you know what? I don't think Republicans, national Republicans right now, are that thrilled with the current field. And we could see. On the Democratic side, yeah, I think there is a little bit. Bernie supporters in the state feel emboldened. I mean, he kicked butt in the primary. He beat Hillary Clinton by 22 points. And that steering committee, the Bernie steering committee, has stayed very cohesive. They meet every month. Here's the thing about this race. You're right. Mark McKenzie was one part of that steering committee. He was a top Bernie supporter in this state. But there are other people who may try to grab that Bernie mantle. And if Bernie voters in New Hampshire split in this primary, then that's not going to be a real calling card right now. That's not going to be the draw, because there could be more than one Bernie candidate. Pappas, of course, he like almost everybody else in the establishment, backed Hillary Clinton in the primary. But Chris Pappas likes to say, I'm not an establishment candidate. I'm not a Hillary Clinton candidate. Look at me on the issues. I can reach out and I can draw in, and you know, the entire Democratic field.
Yeah, Chris, who are you watching here on both sides?
What I'm watching for is to see who is able to distinguish themselves from the rest of the field. It's particularly on the Democratic side, when you have that many candidates, it's easy to get lost in the shuffle. But the flip side of that is that it's possible to win a six-way primary with just, you know, 25 or 30% of the vote. And so it might be somebody who can, you know, activate latent Sanders supporters, or somebody who goes full anti-Trump, or somebody who finds some other means of setting themselves apart from the crowd.
So maybe an issue, maybe organization?
I think either of those.
And you've got some, you know, this field is, you've got a scientist in Mindy Mesner who brought up the whole Seacoast water issues.
Right.
You've got two Iraq War vets, Terrence O'Rourke, who's now the Rochester City Attorney, and you've got Moore Sullivan, thank you, who's the Iraq War vet and Marine who worked in the Pentagon and the Obama administration. It's quite an impressive field. Stay tuned. It's going to be a fun race to cover.
Kevin, what about on the Republican side? Let's say a little bit more about the dynamic there.
Sure.
I think that, you know, there sort of is a risk. Granted, it is a Democratic seat right now, but with such a large field on the Democratic side, we're almost sort of overlooking the Republican side in a lot of what I hear out there in terms of coverage.
Yeah, and back to the point Paul made earlier, the national Republican establishment, if you will, is pretty exercised right now. They feel it's sort of one of the things. They're very critical of Carol Shea Porter, who's not running for re-election, but they respect her political might a great deal. And the fact that she's not running again, this is a great opportunity for them. And in some respects, some of them are underwhelmed by this field right now. Now, we've seen in the past, though, candidates rise to the moment, rise to the occasion. We'll see what Eddie Edwards from Dover, former state liquor commission law enforcement chief, has a kind of compelling story to tell. Andy Sanborn brought about the repeal of the LLC tax, which John Lynch had championed. So he's got some accomplishments, too.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Okay, let's talk a little bit now about CD2, Congressional District 2. And Paul, let me turn to you. Say a little bit about what the district encompasses geographically and a little bit about its political complexion, which is a little bit different than CD1.
Yeah, this is a little bit, swings a little bit more towards the Democrats. The district starts in Salem, New Hampshire. Nashua goes all the way over to the Vermont border and then straight up north to the top of the state, all the way to Canada. geography-wise, it's a little bit larger than the first district. And yeah, it tends to swing a little more Democrat. You've got Annie Custer, the three-term Democratic incumbent. She's running again. I highly doubt she'll have any serious primary challenge. Once again, Annie Custer is going to raise a boatload of money. She's already got about $2 million cash on hand. And you've got two Republicans in the race right now. Steve Negrin, former Air Force veteran, businessman, defense contractor, state rep. And you've also got, help me out here.
Stuart Levinson.
Thank you. from the
whistleblower.
The whistleblower at the New Hampshire Veterans Facility.
Chris, let me ask you a little bit about the incumbent, Annie Custer. Has been in a couple terms now. Has got a couple million dollars in a war chest. How do you think she's her? Although of the again going back to the UNH approval data, we got Hassan at Shaheen at 56%, Hassan at 50, Shea Porter 38, Custer 37. So she's actually the lowest. But a lot of times that's name recognition. Your sense of how vulnerable she might be.
I think, you know, she tends to take her reelection campaign seriously. But I think, you know, going into 2018, if you think it's going to be a Democratic year, I think she's probably feeling more comfortable going into 2018 than she did going into 2014, for instance, which is a really big Republican year, or 2016, where she had a surprisingly close reelection campaign.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that Annie Custer's learned. She won't talk about it publicly, but that the 2016 result rocked her, okay? Here's a candidate with no money, no name recognition, Jim Lawrence, a state representative from Hudson, former state representative, all kinds of personal baggage. I mean, he had issues about, you know, child support and the rest of it, and he gets 46% of the vote against a sitting congressman in a state in which Hillary Clinton wins. And I think Custer was sobered up by that very close result, and she has stepped up. She's kind of energized her press operation in the office. She's much more visible, we're finding, than she had been in the past. So she's gearing up for 2018, and as well she should. She's certainly the favorite. I think one of the things too we need to talk about at some point is the lack of a U.S. Senate election and what that does to this ballot, okay?
Say a little more on that.
It's so important for the governor of the state. Talk to Maggie Hassan about how important it was that Jean Shaheen was on the ballot with her when she had her last reelection fight in 2014. Talk about how important it was for Chris Sununu that he had Donald Trump almost beating Hillary Clinton in 2016, which obviously gave him enough of a ballast. Now, Governor Sununu has neither. And in 2018, he's got to worry about the prospect of Custer rolling up a big result in the 2nd District. And that really hurting him against in his race for reelection against a Democrat. And it could be a rematch with Colin Van Osten. We'll see.
Well, we need to take one more short break. We'll continue talking about the 2nd Congressional District. We'll talk about the governor's race, a little bit about what's going on in the State House. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Dean Spiliotis, in for Laura Kanoy. Today, the political scene in the Granite State, where it is now and where it's headed. You can join us with your questions and your suggestions. Call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm in studio with three guests, Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Chris Galdieri from St. Anselm, and Paul Steinhauser, a veteran New Hampshire political reporter, formerly with CNN. And let's take a call now from John in Hanover. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, this is sort of off the topic you've been talking about, but I'm a Democrat for a number of years. And normally in years when we don't have an obvious candidate for the primary or for the presidential election, we start getting candidates, remarkably, 3-4 years before the actual election. I haven't noticed that this year. Is that something that I'm just missing, or are there just a lack of national candidates, Democratic candidates?
That's a good question. Let me turn to you, Chris.
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that there's no obvious front runner for the Democratic nomination in 2020, but you have seen a few people visit. Bernie Sanders was here, I think, over Labor Day. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, was in town campaigning for Joyce Craig, as was Tim Ryan, the congressman from Ohio. I think, you know, you'll start to see more of that activity with two congressional races and a governor's race. Any presidentially minded Democrat will find their way here.
Yeah, and there is a draft Garcetti group I know, and Martin O'Malley's been here a lot. Although Martin O'Malley was here a lot in 2016, I'm wondering what will be different for him this time. Paul, your thoughts?
Yeah, I did a story on this for the Concord Monitor. Actually, the pace of visits is higher now than it was at all during the 2016 cycle because Hillary Clinton scared a lot of other Democrats off. So we're seeing a ton of people. John Delaney's up here every 2 months, the unknown congressman from Maryland. That's going to continue. That's going to increase, as Chris said, next year. That race is underway.
And thanks for that call, John. Right. Let's go back to talking about CD2. Let me turn to you again, Paul. Interesting name has popped up for a potential Republican candidate in CD2, someone we all know well if you are involved in politics and journalism in the state, Josh McKelvin. A little bit about Josh.
And I got to give credit right here to my good friend Kevin Landergan. He was the first to report about McKelvin over the Thanksgiving holiday. I had a chance to speak to Josh last week, and you can read that article in the Concord Monitor. He is seriously mulling a bid in the 2nd District. He brings a ton of name recognition. Everybody knows him in this state. If he runs, he would run as a Republican. The question is he conservative enough to win a GOP primary?
Yeah, and let's hear what he has to say on that.
I'm not going to bend what I believe in order to win, but I do, fiscal conservative, and I believe I'm not going down there to address social issues, especially things that have already been decided. Socially moderate.
So that was Josh McKelvin talking to Paul Steinhauser. Is that correct, Paul? That was you?
Yeah, that was last week. Yep. If he jumps in this race, it's going to make the 2nd CD race a heck of a lot more interesting. The 1st CD is getting all the limelight right now. But if McKelvin jumps in, let me tell you, we were going to be covering the 2nd CD very, very closely because he's such a no-name. And Kevin made such a great point. There is no presidential race. There's no Senate race. These CD races are going to get a ton of attention this year. They didn't get it. We, unfortunately, were so busy last year. There's only a few of us here in New Hampshire that cover this stuff. We had to recover the presidential race and the Senate race. This year, it's all going to be about the governor and the two CDs and the state house.
Yeah, it really makes a difference what's on the top of the ticket, sort of how far you down you are in the layer cake.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, let me turn to you since you were in on the McKelvin reporting. He says he's fiscally conservative, socially moderate. Charlie Bass, former Republican member of Congress, is that maybe a model for that district?
Yeah, it could be. And Paul wrote about this some in his story, which I thought was really good, is that folks who've been media stars, if you will, there's been a mixed record. Some have been successful at getting into electoral politics. Sometimes the hard part, as we've seen, is people jumping back into the media. That's what a lot of analysts basically say is you can succeed going from media to politics.
It's a one-way door, though.
It's a one-way door. And it's,
unless you want to be an opinion.
Yeah, unless you want to be a talking head on CNN or one of these other shows, it's very difficult to return. And I'm not that I expect Josh would want to return to the media. I think he had a very successful career there, and he's looking for other opportunities, to be sure.
Yeah, and Chris, let me ask you a more general question about elections. We had an email from Greg in West Ossipee, and Greg is wondering if New Hampshire will look past party labels and vote on issues. We have talked a lot about party today. That's often how you talk about elections, but there are others who are more interested in policy. Nancy on Facebook contacted us about the possibility that maybe the focus will be on women's issues. It could be on the tax the big tax plan, which is somewhat controversial. What is your sense of the extent to which this is all going to be filtered or is typically filtered through party rather than kind of no labels and issues?
Yeah, it's really tough for candidates to get around party labels. We belong to parties. We think in terms of parties. And so third-party candidates have tremendous disadvantages just because voters don't think that way. In terms of some of the other things you mentioned, I think keep an eye on women's issues. I think a lot of the energy you're seeing in the Democratic Party is coming from women. And in a state like New Hampshire, where
you have... Big for independence, too, independent women.
Yes. But with New Hampshire politics is so permeable with all these state house seats, with all the local offices people can run for. I think what we'll see is a lot of women running for office in 2018.
The big concern for New Hampshire Republicans, look at these congressional races. It's the old boys club, right? I mean, they're all good candidates. They've all got something to sell. We've talked about all of them. Josh McKelvin, Stuart Levinson, Steve Negrin, Andy Sanborn, Eddie Edwards, Matt Mayberry, all guys. And as we saw in last November, what Republicans need to worry about most is the gender gap. And the gender gap was huge for Democrats on the federal side in November 2016. It is why Carol Shea Porter won back her seat. It is why Maggie Hassan, a gender gap against a female Republican incumbent, Kelly Ayotte. She won among women voters by a large margin.
There is one Republican woman who were in the second seat who may run. That's former state rep Lynn Blackenbecker, who's pretty conservative. She's in the U.S. Navy right now. Her active duty ends in January. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, Paul, let me go back to you on the governor's race. We've talked about the two congressional races, the governor's race. As you noted, Chris Sununu is quite popular, 61% approval overall, I believe. But I think he's got 50% among Democrats, which is quite good. And 70% of people say the state is on the right track. So there is a bit of optimism about New Hampshire's future. Steve Marchand, former Portsmouth mayor, ran for governor last time around, running again. Colin Van Ostern has sort of been in the mix again, who was the nominee last time. Dan Feltis, it's been reported that this is a state senator from the Concord area, might get in. You said a little bit at the beginning of the show that Sununu can't take this for granted, but he'll probably be a pretty formidable opponent, or does he have to worry about a wave hitting him?
No, he will be a formidable opponent. And remember, history in this state, only one governor has lost re-election to a second two-year term in the last 90 years. Those honors, of course, go to Craig Benson. Kevin was covering that pretty closely back in 2004. So the history is with the incumbent to win that second two-year term. The governor has to worry about the national wave and whether Donald Trump could also bring him down. And he's also got to worry about some issues that will come up during the next legislative session that could be a little tricky for him to navigate as he runs for re-election. The new news, yesterday was that we may have another name on the Democratic side, and that is Feltis. Sources telling me that Dan Feltis is seriously considering a bid, and he'll have a decision probably in January or early February. And we're also waiting on Colin Van Ostern, who came very close last time, but lost by about 17,000 votes, I think, or 18,000 votes to Sununu. And Marchand is in. He's been in since March. He got in extremely early. He did better than expected in the primary last time around.
Kevin, your thoughts?
Well, I think Chris Sununu's in an enviable position as a first-term governor. And in a state like we've talked about, in which there's such voter angst about Donald Trump, at this stage, it's really not about personalities. It's not about candidates. It's about moods. And that right track, wrong track question is a very important question now, one year out from this election. And in New Hampshire, is the nation in the right track? 33% say it's in the right track. 61% say wrong track. Only 11% of Democrats say, as a country, we're going in the right direction. How about as a state? 70% say we're going in the right track as a state. And 63% of Democrats say the state is going in the right, is on the right track. That's a very good sign for Sununu. A lot can happen in a year. And as we saw with Craig Benson, an onslaught by a Democratic machine can topple a Republican governor.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Paul, you wanted to
Real quick point on Sununu. Look at the first CD. You've got six Democrats all jumping in, so excited to run. You may get another one or two. Right now in the race for governor, only Marchand is in. Maybe Feltus gets in or Van Ostrom. But you don't have that same scramble, that same enthusiasm right now to jump into the race for governor, because I think a lot of Democrats realize Sununu is going to be real tough to beat.
Yeah. And Chris, let me turn to you. I'm interested for your thoughts on how Sununu has done, particularly with regard to navigating President Trump. Kevin nicely outlined the differences between right track, wrong track here versus nationally. Clearly, Sununu has had some success in separating himself from the controversy around President Trump. I was a little unsure that he was going to be able to do it early in his term. It was a little rocky, kind of got on board with some Trump stuff too quickly and then had to backtrack. He seems to have kind of figured out how to triangulate a little bit.
Yeah, I think he's been, you know, working hard to do that. And if you notice, like, I think a lot of his visits to D.C. are meetings with Vice President Pence rather than with Trump himself, which, again, helps in terms of keeping distance. I think the thing that would keep me up at night if I was managing the Sununu campaign is the prospect of, you know, when you have a big wave year, you always have those couple of races where you have a really good incumbent with a solid record who runs a really good campaign and loses anyway. Jim Talent in Missouri in 2006 or Kay Hagan in North Carolina in 2014. What's really infuriating about that from a campaign perspective is there's not much you can do about that. But I think barring a wave of that size, you know, Sununu is, you know, in a good position.
We are talking about elections in New Hampshire here, so I want to note that Theo reached out to us on Twitter, and Theo says that the New Hampshire GOP is obviously concerned because there's continued activity in terms of changing voter regulations in the state. We've talked in the past about some of these bills designed to tighten up or change, depending on how you view it, voting restrictions, some of them targeting students. We'll likely talk about that stuff on future news roundups. It's a very very popular topic. We only have a little bit of time left, but I'm interested in getting sort of your general thoughts about a little bit of crystal ball activity here about where you think we'll be in terms of the political temperature, let's say spring into next summer. And let me start with you, Paul.
We are going to be full force in campaign mode in the congressional races. I think on the gubernatorial race, Governor Sununu is going to try to keep hands off until the legislative session is over, which is traditionally what the governor is up here
trying to do. Except for maybe we have those tolls, the toll booths.
The tolls will be an issue. And one thing we didn't even talk about, the state house races. Democrats are hungry. They think they can win back one, if not both, chambers of the state house.
Yeah, Kevin.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the key is can the Democrats break through and gain any control of the levers of power at the state like they have at the federal level. I still think it's not a long shot, but thanks to redistricting, it's a much tougher slog for Democrats to win in some of these districts than it was before.
Yeah. Chris?
I think by the spring, early summer, we'll have a better sense of who's running where, not just for the congressional seats, but for the state legislature and other races that are up. And I think that will tell us a lot about how each party is feeling about their prospects in 2018.
Well, the midterm election year is only about 3 or 4 weeks away. I can feel it coming.
Here we go.
But we are out of time. I want to thank all three of my guests, Chris Galdieri, Kevin Landrigan, Paul Steinhauser, all voices you hear regularly here on The Exchange. And I am Dean Spiliotis, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.